chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are right smack dab in the middle of it.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown. How are you, George?
Okay, Charlotte, how you doing this weekend? How'd you like that music, okay?
Yeah, it was excellent. And, boy, we had great weather here in Austin, Texas, didn't we?
Boy, it was beautiful, around 70 degrees both days, Friday evening and all day today. It was just very, very pleasant.
And we hope everybody else across the country is having good weather, too.
Yeah, we've got a real fine guest with us tonight. His name is William Lewis. His background is quite varied, but very talented in scope. He started out with some music in Louisiana, Shreveport, Louisiana. He got into producing music and doing cover, art also. Over 300 musical artists that he did cover art for. And then he got into documentaries. So welcome, William Lewis, to our program. We're proud to have you with us this evening.
George, Charlotte, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we got to mention that you're also the documentaries to your credit are Beyond Treason. What was the other one? In Plain Sight.
Well, I was going to let William tell us a little bit more about his. How did you start out in this creative? These creative.
Well, but
endeavors.
I have to tell him about Washington. You're fired, George.
Yeah, but I want him to tell us a little bit about his background first.
Okay.
All right, so we're to, how did I get started?
Let's go back to the music. George wants to start at the beginning, William. Let's start at the beginning.
Okay, I guess the best way to sum this up is it was about 1995, 1996 when I really started getting onto the Internet. And, yes, the Internet is primarily the tool that I use to wake up. And I began listening to radio programs, alternative news media programs like Jeff Rentz and Alex Jones, and there's a whole host of these things out there that you can listen to. And that really piqued my interest, got me motivated and moving in different directions, things that I had never thought about before, wanting to talk to other people about it. And for the longest time, it was just a phone conversation or, mom and dad or corner my sister in the bedroom and say, hey, let me tell you something I just found out. And it's a hard sell. So I guess the natural progression was to go to music and try and express it through music. And then when I decided that wasn't good enough, I turned to video, which was my other really passionate love since I was a child, wanting to get into the film industry, but not realizing what I was actually going to be doing, which is making basically patriotic documentaries that expose the crime and corruption that goes on in Washington and hopefully gives people some, valid solutions that we can all work together to accomplish.
Right. Now, the art that you did covers, is that right?
That's correct.
And so tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that was Stan Lewis. No relationship to me, but up in the, 60s and 70s, he was signing people like B.B. King and Ike and Tina Turner and Doug Kershaw out of Louisiana, who's a Zydeco band, and there was just a lot happening back then. And, I got in on it about 20 years later after he had already built his music empire, but I was fortunate enough to be able to get in there and design some covers and actually produce some of the music that was coming out of there. So I really, really enjoyed that job.
Wow, that's great. So your first documentary was Beyond Treason?
No, the first one was In Plain Sight.
In Plain Sight, okay.
Yeah, that was, that was me and Dave Von Kleist sitting around looking at footage, and I believe one day Phil Jahan sent us some pictures of this, you know, attachment on the bottom of Flight 77, and we were like, what is that? We were all just kind of flabbergasted, and it motivated us to really start looking through all the footage we had collected, because we had a ton of it, and we were able to find just total inconsistencies in the official story with reports that came out in the first approximately 24 hours of the attack. And so we laid all that out in a CSI analysis of the Pentagon and the World Trade Center and Shanksville. That was my first attempt. It looks like it was shot in a basement because it was shot in a basement.
Well, you're working your way up, right? In a basement upstairs, right?
And William, if you started with Beyond Trees, that would have blown me away. I'd have been like, oh. But
well, did you find, William, did you find that the Pentagon was just an obviously, there's so many obvious problems with that, with the explanation of the attack? I mean, just so obvious that it, some people are still not getting it for some reason.
Well, you know, at the time, some of the main evidence that we had was photographic evidence that had come from FEMA, and it showed some holes that were, you know, approximately 16 feet in diameter. And that really took us by surprise because, you know, we didn't expect a cartoon punch out of a plane in the side of the building, but we expected to see some debris from the wings, which would have been sheared off. And people don't think about these type of things, but, you know, those wings are designed to be sheared off in some type of an emergency landing because they're filled with fuel and they don't want them to ignite and blow up the plane. things of that nature, you know, we just started, it's all logical arguments, you know, if a plane is this diameter and it hits the building, and as the, you know, the graphics that we've been introduced to that were all paid for by, you know, government sources showing us the breakup of the plane on the inside of the Pentagon, none of it was adding up, where the engine landed or the lack of debris or the fact that they couldn't find bodies or the type of wreckage that they said should be there. Even on the scene, eyewitnesses saying, you know, that looked like a missile. It smelled like, explosives. I mean, these people work at the Pentagon. They're DOD. They know what explosives smell like.
Well, some of the experts do. Yeah, some of them walking around would know. I would say not all of them, but some of them definitely would know what it smelled like.
Sure. Well, I'm sure that all of them have gone through basic training where you're taught to recognize all of those things and deal with, battlefield situations. So, yeah, I'm sure that the majority of those people are completely experienced with the smell of...
You'd be surprised how far people can go in the military without actually knowing stuff like that, but not to distract from your point. It's well taken. I agree. If there were people, eyewitnesses at the Pentagon saying that, that holds a tremendous amount of weight in my book.
There were some early photographs, too, right there in front on the front lawn there in front of where the damage was initially done. They're just obvious. There's no debris out there. There's one photograph.
True, from about four different angles.
Yeah, there's one in particular that shows it's from the right side. As you're looking at the damage, it would be coming in from the right side at about a 45-degree angle. And that photograph, I think, is the most insightful photograph I've ever seen of the Pentagon, you know, shortly after, a couple of hours after the actual attack.
Well, we were told by many different sources that there was a, you know, 60-foot crater made by this plane as it scraped along the, you know, lawn of the Pentagon and hit the building, but we didn't see any of those marks on the lawn. It was perfect. It was clean and clear debris, and you didn't see the hole. The crater that they were talking about wasn't there either.
That's right. We've got to cut away here for a break, but we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thank you very much. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown, and welcome back, William Lewis, creator of Washington, You're Fired. I think that's an awesome documentary.
Thank you. That was, I guess, the natural progression of, you know, the other four documentaries, kind of building upon one on top of the other till I got to Washington, You're Fired. I tried to keep the other one simple, maybe a little more conspiratorial, if you will, but, you know, we really, really paid attention to the details in Washington, You're Fired to make sure that we weren't introducing anything that could be considered conspiratorial. It's just, it's very, you know, factually based, and it's all based on the Constitution. We were fortunate enough to be able to have the help of Jonathan Turley, who was a well-known constitutional attorney in D.C. And, you know, we've got some great footage of him, of course, in the documentary, but the whole purpose of this was to bring in a circle of people that I could bounce questions off, you know. If I say it this way, am I wrong? You know, so
sure.
We wanted to make really sure that there were no holes that could be drilled in this thing. It's, you know, just we wanted rock solid, and I hope you looked at it and agree.
Yeah, I agree fully on that. It was very credible.
I have a quote. I got a surprise for you. I have a quote about Washington, You're Fired from G. Edward Griffin. G. Edward Griffin says, if you're serious about positive change in government, you simply must see this documentary and then take action. Ta-da!
And Sean, just got that the other day, didn't you, Sean?
Yes, I did. And, of course, Alex Jones said hard-hitting, and Jeff Rentz said superb. So you've gotten rave reviews. It's a, and I absolutely loved it. For me, it was a, I'm so grateful, and I'm grateful that you did this documentary. There's a, I have a certain gratitude. I can't even, you know, and we got it. And thank you so much for creating it. It's going to be a tremendous tool, in helping save our republic.
Well, I think it's one word. If I had one to think of, it's very chilling about what's going on in this country. In the sense that it's going to wake people up.
Well, if you know, I had to say a quote, and if everybody knew who Charlotte Littlefield Brown was, I would say, it will rock your world.
Rock your world. We can't use the word bomb now. We can't do that.
No, rock.
We're going to rock your world out, right?
It will rock your world. Your paradigm will come crashing down.
And, I mean, it's unfortunately, it's true. You know, you said it was chilling. And, you know, most of these documentaries do come across as kind of macabre and just, I guess scary is the best word. They're kind of like horror documentaries. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but when you're dealing with topics like these, it is very, very terrifying, the implications and just the flat-out fact that a lot of these things, a lot of these laws are on the books and can be used at any time and often are.
Yeah, it's, we're living in very dangerous times, much more dangerous, I think, than it's been in decades.
If you look at that Reichstag fire and you look at these laws that have been passed in the last year and a half, it is chilling.
Since 9/11, even.
You know, those laws, the Enabling Act in Germany and that Reichstag, you know what I mean, act or bill, I think it was, and all that, just over just a few weeks there, right before Hitler took over. Very chilling.
Yeah, and the other parallel would be the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin resolution that, you know, basically is the same thing that happened to, that they gave to Johnson, they have given to Bush. Very dangerous times indeed.
So how long did it take you to do this Washington, You're Fired documentary? How long did it take you to produce that and put it together?
I started shooting for it about 2006, right there at the beginning, and we were able to cover some events on September the 11th in a couple of different times, in 2005 or 6 and 2007. And, you know, those were great crowds. People were coming out because they knew what was going on with 9/11. And, you know, it was a great motivator to see those large crowds out there and go up and talk to those people. And they actually know what you're talking about when you say, hey, tell me about 911, or hey, tell me about the government, or, you know, in Washington, you can just walk up to a stranger and say, hey, I'm shooting a documentary on the government. You want to say something on camera? And, wow.
My gosh.
They want to be heard, don't they?
They want a voice. That is what this is all about. And the people of this country have lost their voice.
If we ever had one. The media is a deception. you know, it's a deception. I don't know that we ever really had a voice. Did we lose it, or we're just gaining it now?
I'd like to think that the founders put the First Amendment in there because we actually did have a voice, and they wanted us to have a voice. That's about the freedom of the press, and yes, you're right. The media has been overtaken by the corporations of this country. In any other country, we'd be calling it fascism right now,
yeah,
because that's what it is.
Special interests, absolutely.
Yes, and you know, this is just that unfortunately the state that we are in right now in this country is that we have arrived at the doorstep of fascism, and we are beginning to see the effects.
Well, we have to read some of these foreign newspapers to get a more objective view sometimes. You know what I mean? I read The Guardian over there and some of those newspapers in London and Ireland and Dublin. You know what I mean?
Well,
because our news is so, you know, homogenized or sanitized, I guess, is the word.
Well, I, gentlemen, I think we're in for an evolution. I was looking up the actual definition of fascism and or fascist, and it's really not good enough for the modern times that we're living in, because it acknowledges, like, government, you know, overreaching and taking control. But we have a special kind of fascist problem, and our problem has to do with the corporations controlling our government. They stand in line at the Federal Reserve through Citibank and all these other, you know, high international banking, you know, banks, and they get the money, and they control our legislators through the lobbying process. I mean, we have a genuine corporate fascist problem, and they're running they're running our government with negligent disregard for the sovereignty of individuals and individual, freedoms.
The term fascist, I mean, the basic definition is simply either a government who is taking over control of the corporation or corporation who is, you know, taking over control of the government. Either way, it's the same result. And I believe it was Mussolini who said that fascism could be more credibly stated as a term called corporatism. And that's what we're looking at in this country, is corporatism has taken over every aspect of government. You've got the corporations side by side in Washington, D.C., with our Capitol buildings and all of our infrastructure. They are the CEOs of those companies who are congressmen. Okay, hello. They don't have our best interests in mind, people, and I don't have to tell you that. You already know it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I would even go as far as saying, you know, the concept. Everybody over the last 20 years, the corporate model started saying, well, we will call people customers, and you find people in government calling the sovereign people of America customers. You find people in the military calling people, their soldiers and stuff, or this and that, customers. It's like,
okay, we got to cut out of here, Charlotte. We'll be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, William Lewis. Yes, sir. How are you this evening? All right. On this fascism dynamic, there was an early, organizer ideas that were put forward by a man by the name of Giuseppe Mazzini. Italian. He preceded, he was early on before the 1900s in Italy. He was part of the nationalist movement or the freedom movement in Italy. He was also a member of the Carbonari, a secret association with political purposes in Tuscany. And so he fomented a lot of revolution. Well, his early idea of fascism was a partnership between the trade guilds at that time and government. Now, I believe if you sort of extrapolate that into modern times, into the present times, you would have to say a new partnership has developed, dominated by the corporations along with government.
I mean, it's true. Yeah, all the way down to utilities. I mean, look at the corporations now are involved with our utilities, which are supposed to be nonprofits, but you know, you go to sign up for what cable these days, and you're given a choice. Do you want telephone service through this? Would you like to have Dish Network? Would you like to have X, Y, or Z? I mean, they're in it for the money these days.
And I would go transfer over to the roads. It's even getting up. What it is private-public partnerships, you know, on the roads, as far as Trans-Texas Corridor and toll roads and things like that. But, yeah, the private-public partnership seems to be the model that they're using. George called it the don't PPP on me. And I think that's funny because, you know, essentially that, George, would you agree that's sort of the fascist dynamic?
In fact, let me tell you who owns seven major airports in Great Britain today. It is one of these corporations. It's called BAA out of Spain. Okay? And if you go back and you dig down in there and drill down in there, you're going to find that Grupo Ferro Viril actually owns what they call BAA Limited, that owns seven major airports, including Gatwick and Heathrow in England. So they've taken over a lot already, you know. It's been like a sleeper out here, and people are finally waking up and saying, uh-oh, you know, and finally realizing that even in England there's a dispute or, you know, a disagreement about this foreign company owning their airports.
Well, I'm glad they see a problem with it as well. You know, we kind of look to England and the U.K. as a barometer for the United States and what's going to happen here, because we're watching these rights being taken away, many of which they necessarily didn't have in the first place. But, you know, we have friends in England who are absolutely fed up. They're ready to sell their property. They're, you know, fed up with all of the taxes and just, you know, you can't make a living over there anymore. You're spied upon everywhere you go. They have 3 billion cameras around London or something. I think it's 3 million, excuse me, cameras around London. I mean, it's just a situation for him that has turned into 1984. You know,
well, they've got them. Yeah, the cameras up there talk to you, don't they?
Yes. Can't wait to get those here.
I was over there a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, and there was a sea out there in the middle of the road in the Westminster area. And I asked this guy and his wife, I said, what's that sea? And they own this little sandwich shop down by my hotel. And they said, this is a congestion street. I said, what does that mean? They said, well, if you get caught on it, you get fined without permission. It's like a toll street over there they have within London.
Wow.
You have to have a special permit to be on certain streets in London today.
That is incredible.
Yeah, it's another example of, you know, just how far gone the control grid is. And
I got you. Now when we're talking about this control grid, you said you have some friends over in London and England there, and they're saying that it's like a big maze of controls and what fees and fines and everything. Is that what, and taxes and everything just getting, you know, just excessively high?
Correct. And, you know, they're literally going to move out of the country. You know, we think of ourselves over here, a lot of people wanting to expatriate and just get out before it's too late. And it's sad to say that some of the places that we may have thought were going to be safe havens, of course, I never considered London one, but, you know, those places are more infiltrated than here. So, you know, the question comes back to where do you go? And I don't know that there is a place. I want to say that, you know, we can find one, but I think the best solution is for us to stand on our feet, everyone,
stand
together.
No. Stand up and say no. No to the Real ID, no to the Patriot Act, no to the Military Commissions Act. Let's get rid of that Neanderthal, but that antiquated, you know, help me out, guys, terrorist.
Well, there's 1955 that was passed in November of 2007.
Yeah, Domestic Terrorist
Prevention
Act or whatever.
Here's what it's called. It's called the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorist Prevention Act of 2007.
I mean, they did that in the 50s, and it resulted in a whole lot of chaos and nonsense. And whoever that woman, what does she use as a model? What is she thinking? This has already been happening in our country, and it didn't work. This is
I think they got their numbers wrong. I think it should have been H.R. 1984.
Oh, yeah. William, you make a good point there.
Yeah, this lady that we're talking about, Jane Harman, a Democrat out of California, I never thought we would see this coming from the Democrat side, but, I mean, it took Republicans and Democrats to get us into this mess, and I guess we've brainwashed our Democrats sufficiently now so that they're going to introduce the same type of unconstitutional and just flat-out damaging bills.
Well, absolutely. And you know, William, what I think? I think they think they're running a corporation. And I think that they would be right in assuming that the United States government is a corporation. However, the citizenry, I don't even like to call us citizens, but us sovereign people of America, we consider ourselves a country. And this type of legislation is something that would be passed in a boardroom of a corporation, not in like a country of our own. You know, they're thinking they're using the highest business techniques and the latest tracking and the, you know, they're just high speed, low drag, when in fact they're taking us straight into tyranny and they can't even see it.
That's because, unfortunately, they think that they know better than we do. This is where we have a problem with our executive branch in the past 7 or 8 years, totally out of control, usurping powers that were never intended to be given to the president. And quite honestly, this is just the thinking in Washington now. It's no longer how can we pass legislation that will support the Constitution. It's how can we pass legislation that'll get us around it, give us a back door. Let us do things that are maybe not so scrupulous, and, you know, we'll be able to get away with it. This is why, you know, we were talking about London being such a grid. If we get the National ID Act, which we obviously are, I mean, many people may not realize, but it was voted down in the House, but they resurrected that thing under H.R. 1268, which was an appropriations bill. It had to do with tsunami relief. It was literally tucked in at the very last hour, and it was signed.
That's so deceptive. That is so immoral. It is wrong. It is stupid. Stupidity. This is the highest level of ignorance and malicious disregard for our country, that they would just put it attached to an appropriations bill. How underhanded, the scoundrels.
Well, they've done this over the years. They'll just put it in there in the end somewhere.
I find it intolerable. I don't know about you, sovereign Americans,
well,
but
you know,
I find this intolerable.
You know what I think about it, but, but you know, there was one point you brought about the U.S. Patriot Act. There was a substitute bill, right, that was put together right there at the night before?
Kind of a long story.
Let's do that when we come back. Let's discuss that a little bit. I'd like to hear a little more detail on that. We got to go right now. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield Brown.
Welcome back, William Lewis.
Hello.
Welcome back to the program. we were gonna get you a promo on take it back. You know what is your site to get your DVDs and things like that? DVDs.
That's takebackwashington.com.
Okay.
And we kind of provide that as a portal for all of the videos. There's radio interviews, articles. People can go up and look at footage that we couldn't include in all of the documentaries, but we wanted to make sure that people get to see it, so we stream a lot of that stuff from the website. So people go up and take advantage of it, because there's a lot of resources there, a lot of organizations that you can get involved with that will bring about the changes that we talk about in the documentary.
Washington, you're fired.
And takebackwashington.com is the site. Now, what about the U.S. Patriot Act? There was a substitute bill at a late hour that was substituted for what they had signed off on earlier, Congress?
Yeah.
Happened on that?
Well, if you'll remember back, we were just attacked. I mean, we're talking like within 4 about 4 or 5 weeks after the attacks that this was going on. You know, nobody was taking breaks. They were working through the weekends in Washington, and there was, you know, they were motivated to get some legislation passed to make them look good.
And I was at that point in time, the molten metal in the basement, the World Trade Center 1 and 2, was still quite hot.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Okay, while the molten steel was still hot in the basement of the World Trade Center, they were trying to...
Yeah, the poor firemen were getting poisoned by all the, toxic smoke.
I think it was 6 or 7 weeks out, the boots were still melting on the rubble pile. So the legislators were running around like chickens with their head cut off in a panic, in a duress mode, under duress.
Yeah, probably without very much sleep. And the House had their own version. And they called it the Patriot Act, all right? And the Senate had their version, and they called it the USA Act. And if you'll remember back, there was discussion about combining the two into one, calling it the USA Patriot Act. Well, this is where we have to go back a little bit further. There's an individual, his name is Viet Dinh. That's V-I-E-T-D-I-N-H, Viet Dinh. And at the time, he was head of the Office of Legal Policy for the Justice Department. But my problem here is that Viet Dinh was born in communist-controlled Saigon, Vietnam. He did come here to the United States with his family. He moved them here. They all became citizens. But at the very last minute, 3:45 in the morning, the president ordered the printers to print up the substitute bill written by Viet Dinh and have it put onto the House floor to be signed into law. And, you know, this is where we had several of our congressmen getting up there on the House floor and screaming their heads off about not giving us enough time to read this bill. Please just give us the weekend to read it. You remember all the comments at the time and the pleas for, a reasonable time to be able to digest this bill and understand what it encompasses, but there was no time to do it, and just about every one of them signed off on it, Republicans and Democrats alike, I believe, because they needed cover, they needed to look good. Just the simple matter of fact is we had just been attacked and everyone got caught with their pants down. This was a way for them to pull up their pants.
But, you know, it's a semantic deception because the USA Patriot Act or the Patriot Act, it's not patriotic. It just was so damaging to the American, founding documents, the principles of this country. I mean, what was left?
It was written by a communist, and if we take a look at it now, it's not hard to recognize that fact.
Perhaps a better way to say that is it was written by a person whose early life was influenced by the communist doctrine. And
perhaps
he had internalized it to a point that when he went for his creative juices, he ended up writing something that was not in tune with our founding documents, our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, or even our Declaration of Independence.
Could you say the anthrax attacks were like a cattle prod also, putting pressure on Congress?
That's what I believe. I believe I've got a number of...
Those are genuine terrorist attacks. Those anthrax to the congressman, and William, I've never been able to verify this. Perhaps you've been able to in your research and your studies, but I was under the impression that the people that were sent the anthrax were the ones that were opposing the Patriot Act.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I don't have my notes sitting here in front of me on this, and I can't name off some of the people for you.
Daschle was one of them? Senator Daschle?
Well, that's terrorism right there. That is genuine, bona fide terrorism, mafioso-style, you better either not show up or you better vote this way.
Well, you know, after the 9/11 and then you had this anthrax thing, even the public was really upset, weren't they?
Well, sure. I mean, and it wasn't just necessarily, I believe, to get legislation passed. It was to keep the fear factor up.
Sure, sure. They got the public going.
There were other things that they wanted to do. I mean, people, if you remember back, they wanted to forcibly inoculate everyone with smallpox vaccines. And I I mean, there was discussion at the time about mandatory anthrax, which at the time, you know, had already been determined to contain squalene and was responsible for killing off some of our military, and at least making a good number of them sick and giving them nervous disorders and things that we now attribute or call Gulf War illness. But, you know, those are the type of plagues that would have been unleashed on the population of the United States if we had been forced to take smallpox and anthrax vaccines.
And, you know, there's so, I'm speechless on that one. There's so many weaponized viruses, weaponized, you know, chemical, radiological, biological, you know, stuff out there, you know, to zero in on one. It's like every year they think they know what flu is coming, and it's an educated guess. When it comes to what potential weaponized chemical, biological, radiological thing can be used against us, you cannot zero it down to one likely, this is what they're likely to hit us with. It's not feasible. It's not a true calculation. It's a wild guess. But obviously they knew something, right? Or, you know, there was some sort of catalyst that guided people. Well, obviously people were sent anthrax in the mail, you know.
But the anthrax...
People were afraid to go get their mailbox. You know, they were afraid to open their mailbox and look at their mail.
Well, the anthrax that was used, though, was highly... it was highly...
Weaponized.
Yeah, weaponized. And only a highly sophisticated lab could have processed that kind of anthrax, is my understanding. Lynn Horowitz testified last week earlier on, I think, Alex Jones show or one of those, and he has some of the best detail on where this came from. I would direct people to some of his writings on that particular aspect.
Did he say Texas?
Lynn Horowitz.
No. Did Lynn Horowitz say that he believed he could track it back to Texas?
No, not Texas, but it wasn't to Fort Detrick. It was to another location in the country.
Maine? Was it Maine?
No, it was I'm thinking it was a Midwest location, but what they did was it was processed in such a way to make it even more airborne than the normal anthrax.
We had
it was very lethal, a form of it that they normally don't encounter.
And that's
very,
why
very,
they know it to be weaponized.
Yes, but it went past the normal processing, you know what I mean, stages and techniques to get it into a form that was trying to remember some of the descriptions that he used. Not isotopes, but some kind of a charged or something that some way it became more airborne and much more lethal in the way that they had processed it. But I would direct people back to Lynn Horowitz's site, and, you know, he has really a definitive answer on that way, way early on this.
Absolutely. Back in, I want to say 2002, when all of this had taken place, I was actually at the time working as a radio producer for American Freedom News. And we talked to an individual in Texas who was responsible for supplying the CDC with the strain of anthrax that was actually used in the attacks. And the way he believes it was done is, you know, he was actually called by the FBI or by the CDC and requested to send this particular strain of anthrax to them. And I believe later they ended up indicting this man and, I'm not sure that I'm supposed to say his name, so I'm going to.
Yeah, let's leave that out for now. That might be more harmful to him than doing him any good. We're going to have to take a break here at the top of the hour. We've got about a 6-minute break coming up, so now's the time to take care of all the things we need to take care of. We'll come back after the top of the hour. And thank you very much, William Lewis. We certainly appreciate your contributions and all your documentaries.
Washington, you're fired.
We'll be back. Washington, you're fired.